Hi, I'm Saturn, and this is Climate to Action, a California State University San Marcos student podcast.
And my name is Alex. We're here to amplify voices, explore solutions to climate change, and address climate justice for all living things.
We are committed to incorporating discussions on indigenous knowledge in addressing the climate crisis and including a call to action in every episode.
But first, we'd like to acknowledge that our university and studio are located on the traditional territory of the Luiseno Payam-Cowichan people.
CSUSM and its surrounding areas are still home to the 6 federally recognized bands of the La Jolla, Paula, Palma, Pechenga, Rincon, and Saboba Luiseno Payam-Cowichan people.
It's also important to acknowledge that this land remains the shared space among the Kupeño, Kumeyaay, and Ipai peoples.
For today's episode, we wanted to take a deep dive into how the climate crisis is reported in the news.
To get a behind-the-scenes look into the world of climate crisis reporting, we've invited two very special guests. Let's welcome Mackenzie Elmer, an environment and energy reporter from Voice of San Diego, and Corey Suzuki, a reporter and visual journalist from KPBS. Thank you both for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So you both report on climate and environmental issues, and you do really great work. But before we get into that, please tell us a bit about yourselves.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much for having us. I'm Corey. I am the South Bay and Imperial Valley reporter at KPBS. My position is through the California Local News Fellowship. So we're a network of reporters that are placed across the state for 2 years. We are placed in cohorts. So I was placed in San Diego along with several colleagues at different newsrooms. And I've been covering the environment and climate change for a while now. I come from a mostly radio background. Mm-hmm. Got my start in public radio, working at small community radio stations in the Bay Area. And so I some of the first stories that I worked on at those stations were about tensions between the need for more housing and for climate change measures and to protect endangered species or species that are at risk of becoming endangered. So it's something that I've been thinking about for a while. And in my position now at KPBS, it plays a really big role in both of the regions that I cover. In South Bay, Chula Vista, National City, Imperial Beach, these are all places that are experiencing, like the rest of San Diego County, the kind of early tremors of the climate crisis. And the Imperial Valley, even more so, is an area that sees some of the most extreme heat waves in the Western United States, and is also experiencing multiple different sort of slow moving elements of climate change and how the crisis sort of collides with things like water use and agriculture. So climate change is a really big part of sort of all of the work that I do at KPBS.
Nice. Well, thanks for all that you do.
Yeah, seriously.
Thanks for having me.
I have so many questions about radio, but first I want to give Mackenzie a chance to introduce herself.
Yeah, thanks. So I am from the Midwest. I got my start in journalism at the University of Iowa, studying journalism. And that's where I kind of first got into like environmental topics. I'm one of those kids who's sort of weird and who always knew they wanted to be a journalist once I heard about that was a thing you could do for a living. And I always was just interested in science as a person. I remember reading about climate change in like a National Geographic magazine, early 2000s. And they were talking about throwing up huge mirrors in space to reflect the sun's radiation to like prevent global warming from happening. And I thought like, well, that's crazy. There's gotta be better solutions than that. Like maybe not create greenhouse gases in the first place. So I went to school, studied up, started doing a little bit of environment reporting there, but then kind of started in a very traditional like newspaper journalism career. I started at a small paper next to the Mississippi River, did a bit of reporting on some like the problem of fertilizer on farms and how it can pollute the Mississippi River. And then kind of just worked my way up. I did crime beat. I covered the state legislature. I kind of dabbled in some water wars when I started covering City Hall in Des Moines. But there weren't any environment reporting jobs back then. They were kind of few and far between. It wasn't really as it is now. It's sort of taking off, and it seems like every outlet has an environment or climate reporter. So I moved to California to do some graduate school work at Scripps Institution of Oceanography and studied climate science and policy there for about a year. And then this gig opened up at Voice of San Diego, where I work now. And I started in March of 2020, right before the pandemic hit, and just kind of spent a lot of time, you know, thinking about these issues and studying them in my garage, as there were a lot of environments to go out into, really, during that time. But climate, since I studied that at Scripps, it really permeates every topic. You can pretty much find a climate angle. Maybe you can challenge me later, like find a climate angle in like any topic you pick, because it is truly a global phenomenon that we really don't know how to stop or slow down in any real way at the moment. And so, yeah, I'm excited to sit here and talk with you guys about everything climate reporting.
So do you think the climate crisis is being covered accurately and efficiently in the news? Mackenzie, would you like to share your thoughts first?
Well, the news is a very large grouping of people who are in the media. I would say the climate crisis has become definitely a more accepted concept. Maybe even just 10 years ago, you definitely had like a split where conservative politicians and just sort of conservatively maybe news outlets sort of refused to acknowledge that climate change was a thing or a real term, or that was had any scientific basis. And that's, you know, a lot of that's because there's a lot at stake for the economies of scale that we can get into later. You know, fossil fuels really drive the global economy, and to say and to try to accept the climate crisis as real, it means those types, sorts of businesses are at risk. And I think, but I think more and more you kind of see, especially as we have experienced more like climate-driven weather-related catastrophes, not to mention like multiple catastrophic floods locally across the country, hurricanes. Like I think you see this divide sort of like smoothing out, and I think there's been some more acceptance on both sides of the aisle. And I think media outlets are doing a better job of hiring people who are more trained in understanding the science and have more like backgrounds in science as well, which can be useful. So I've definitely seen like it getting better. Can it always improve? Of course. But I think it's just a matter of, you know, kind of sometimes trial and error for a lot of these news outlets, and like, what's the best way we can locally make climate matter? And I'd be curious to hear what Corey thinks about that too.
Yeah, you want to share your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you said, Mackenzie. I mean, I think that so much has changed in the way that the press cover climate change, the press as a whole, and like you mentioned, I mean, there's so many different parts of what today is the news media. I mean, like right now, it's newspapers, it's nonprofit news organizations, it's public radio, it's public television, it's commercial television, cable news, and then there's sort of like a whole ecosystem too of influencers and other people who are also, I think we can safely say now, part of the media and part of the groups of people who distribute information and influence how people think. Although I think all of those are at like sort of different levels of produce different levels of accurate information. But I think, I mean, in terms of like sort of journalists in the traditional sense and in terms of legacy newsrooms, I think for a long time, I mean, I think the press did a very bad job of covering the climate crisis and climate change. I mean, in the you know, even in the early 2000s, the early 2010s, I mean, there has for a long time been this sort of kind of instinct by journalists to create some sort of equivalence between the people who say that climate change is happening, the you know, massive scientific consensus that this is something that is unfolding around the world. And climate deniers, people who would spread misinformation and who say that climate change is a hoax, or that it's not necessarily going to be as bad as researchers predict it will be. And so I think just for a really long time, there was sort of that instinct among the press to kind of hold up both of those sides of or both of those perspectives as equal, instead of sort of looking to the researchers that were tracking these very real in places like Hawaii and other parts of the world who were tracking this very real rise in carbon emissions. And I think we'll get into later, but there were massive companies too, fossil fuel companies that were doing research at the time and had also come to some to similar conclusions. So it's not necessarily that we should blame the press for the slow pace of action on climate change for all of it necessarily. But I do think it's important to say that the press has played a role in being slow to recognize the dangers of climate change in the beginning. And I think part of that, I mean, is that, you know, it's such a massive thing to kind of wrap your head around. I mean, and all of us as people are kind of, you know, our brains aren't necessarily wired to sort of think about problems at this kind of massive scale and massive timeline. That's sort of something that is not always easy for us to think about in terms of, you know, thinking about like millions of birds or hundreds of thousands of species. Those large scales are difficult to comprehend, but I still think it's important to say that we've played a role in the slow pace of action on climate change. But I agree with Mackenzie that things have changed a lot. And I really feel like, too, there was one year to me that really stood out in terms of when sort of, I think, the climate disasters that we're starting to see, the extreme weather that we're starting to see that has been linked with climate change, sort of started to take hold a little bit more within the kind of the minds of sort of everyone who is in the press or journalists in the press. And I think that was in the summer and the year after of 2020. I mean, in January, there were these massive wildfires that were happening in Australia of that year. And then throughout that kind of whole year, there were just all of these other, you know, on top of COVID, there were all of these other environmental disasters that took place across the world that I think in some ways, you know, the wildfires in Northern California that turned the skies orange.
Yes.
Things like that that were really hard for people to look away from and to kind of to pretend like they weren't happening. So I think that to me that was one year that I feel like was a little bit of a turning point also in terms of awareness within the press.
I think it's like scaring people to all of these things that are happening, all mm-hmm. of the, like you guys are saying, the natural disasters, because before climate change wasn't really something I would hear about often. And now with media and the news and everything we have, it's also important for like youth that we have like social media, TV, streaming, everything. We have it more exposed if people are interested to talk about it, and also to take climate action. I feel like we want to talk about climate change, but then also not talk about what we can do to combat it as well. And I know, Mackenzie, I think you were going to say something.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I just wanted to follow up on one of Corey's earlier points. It's true that journalists, I think, in our ethos, we learn of, you know, objectivity being like the most important thing in journalism. Objectivity meaning like, you know, talk to as many sources as you can and present all sides and try to get as close to the truth as possible, kind of got in our way in the climate crisis perspective, because we, for years, as Corey was saying, we framed it as a debate, though we have, you know, 99% of scientists agreed that climate change is real and it's caused by use of fossil fuels, etc. Like, that's a very accepted and well understood for decades by science. but journalists and media continue to treat it as a debate. And whenever we talked to a scientist about climate change, we would talk to a skeptic so that we felt we had both sides of the story represented. I think it wasn't until I think the LA Times may have been one of the first papers I realized or recognized had taken a stance. And they, I think they produced like an editorial to that effect that said, we're no longer going to frame this as a debate. We're just going to talk about climate change. Like it's a fact, it's real, it's happening. And we're no longer going to like take this stance. And that's another thing about Voice of San Diego. We don't purport to be like traditional, like objective journalism. We understand and accept and own that like objectivity is virtually unattainable. We're all human. We have subjectivity. We have values. And so that's why, like, as part of our mission statement, we share what our values are as a news organization, so the readers can go to that and they know that, you know, we believe that climate change is real. We believe that a clean environment, you know, is important. And so we will have like a stance on some of these things to that effect. And I think that's really important as well. And more you see news outlets of all types of political backgrounds taking that kind of stance.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Actually, I guess just going off of that, Mackenzie, I am kind of curious what you think about how sort of coverage of climate change has been in this election cycle, because I feel like we've like a lot has changed, but at the same time, I've sort of throughout this this last year leading up to the November election, I've had this feeling kind of that the kind of question of what a shift in the American political landscape will mean for climate change has not really been at the forefront of the conversation as much. And I feel like it sometimes feel like it should be like the thing at the forefront of the conversation about what is going to happen over the next 4 years. And so I don't know. I mean, I'm curious what you all think about how that has looked.
I guess since you asked me first, Corey, I will just say, even looking locally at San Diego politics, you know, Mayor Todd Gloria, City of San Diego mayor, he talked about climate change a lot. Talked a big game about climate, you know, passed a new climate action plan, like basically an updated or his own version of it in his first term. And then the second time around, climate change was not a topic at all in the political spectrum. Like very, very rarely was it brought up. And I think that's climate change often falls off the political agenda locally, nationally, globally, when there are other types of crises that sort of grab hold of everyone's attention, which is often like everyone's dealing with the economic outfall of COVID, inflation, people are just worried about their expensive groceries and don't really have time to worry about, you know, the sea level rising in 20 years and engulfing the beaches of San Diego necessarily. I think it's, and that's, you know, that's fair in some respects. And politics is a natural like 4 year cycle. Like it's naturally set in these sort of short term vision timelines. So, you know, it's hard to keep climate change relevant. Unfortunately, the human race is one that doesn't respond well unless it's an emergency. And so I think what we'll continue to see are like when we feel the grip of climate change sort of like on our economy, like for instance, I do a lot of reporting on the Colorado River, which is like the main source of water for San Diego. And that is super affected by climate change. The water's overused, it's drying up in certain areas. We got to find out a solution. When we had that drought that lasted a couple of years, 2 years ago, climate change was kind of like back on the map. And so we'll see it pop up again, I think, but this last election cycle really, you know, there wasn't a lot of space for it. It was a lot about like, you know, Biden v. Trump, then, you know, Kamala v. Trump. And then that was like the most pressing crisis was like this huge party swing, and we'll feel the outfall of that later. And even locally, I think just like homelessness and inflation and, petty theft at CVS stores, those are the things that like everyday people really feel in their pocketbook and worry about. And we don't really talk about climate unless potentially we have like a flood sweep through a neighborhood, which we did, but how quickly we moved on to other things. It's just the human nature, unfortunately. But it's up to us journalists to keep it, keep it in everyone's headspace as much as we can. And that's why I think you probably do this, and I do this too. We try to like make those connections when relevant within a story, even if it's not about climate change. I make sure to mention, like, I'm talking about air pollution related to like, I talk about fossil fuels. I always mention like, fossil, like planet warming fossil fuels is what I will say instead of just fossil fuels. Or if I talk about climate change, I'll say human caused climate change to like on repeat, get that message out to the public over and over again that, those two things are related.
Why is it important to you to say human caused climate change?
Because a lot of people get confused. I think like there is a certain sect of the population that doesn't want to like talk about climate change or be kind of on that. They don't want to live in that climate crisis mindset. And one excuse, which is still relevant, is to say, well, the climate has always been changing. So why, why are you calling it climate change now? And that's true. The natural earth, unaffected by humans and our use of fossil fuels, changed on regular timescales. We had ice ages, and then those would melt, and we would have flooding, warm periods. And it's important, though, to say human cause, because we are part of the industrial revolution still. The last 200 years, we've been burning fossil fuels, which put CO2 in the atmosphere, which warmed the planet. And that's warming the planet on timescales like unseen by the, billion plus year history of the Earth. And so we need to, so that's why I say human caused climate change, because I'm specifically talking about the climate change that we are ourselves basically like speeding up with our activities. So it's my way of like trying to sort of succinctly say all of that in a short terminology and cause people to think too, like, why am I saying human caused climate change instead of just climate change? Like, there's a reason. And maybe it will cause people to think a little bit about it. Sometimes it just enrages people, and I get emails about that.
What makes you really passionate regarding the climate crisis? Corey, if you would like to go first.
Sure. I don't consider myself an very outdoorsy person. I don't really like camping very much. And I'm not sort of also necessarily like, I don't always feel like I have this like deep connection with nature or wildlife. And I think that I bring that up because I feel like that for a long time has been a really sort of the dominant narrative of the environmental movement broadly, but also just a very big part of environmental journalism. And I don't think that, like, I don't say that to say that sort of, movements to save like the burrowing owls aren't important. I think that's incredibly important. Biodiversity is important. And I do, on a very fundamental level, think that our relationship with nature is broken, especially in this country, where kind of the idea of sort of dominance over nature has been a very kind of foundational idea from sort of the early years of the country, and tied in with other foundational ideas like white supremacy. But I think that at the same time, I personally feel like what I'm always drawn to more so in reporting and in stories is just kind of trying to focus in on how climate change, the climate crisis, other environmental issues are affecting people and people's lives, and especially people who, haven't necessarily have been ignored by the press, or haven't been listened to, or have been spoken for. Because I think that while all of these different facets of how the world is being affected by the climate crisis are important, I think there's also something that's wrong with an approach that where, you know, foundations and donors are pouring millions of dollars into saving these individual species of animal, for example, like the burrowing owl, and not thinking about their neighbors, and not thinking about people who are also facing the impacts that are currently happening of the climate crisis, extreme heat, flooding, all of these different things that are having a real impact on people's lives right now. And so that's where I try to I think that's where I'm most drawn to personally, but that's also I think where I try to focus my reporting as much as possible. And so that I think that just in sort of the day-to-day work, that looks like a lot of in as much as I can reporting on environmental justice issues and indigenous sovereignty. Those are sort of some of the main reporting threads that have come up, especially in my work in the Imperial Valley, which is where a lot of my climate and environment reporting takes place. Those sort of specific threads are what I try to focus on.
Yeah, there's almost too many interesting pieces of the climate crisis to tell. I think the work Corey is doing in Imperial Valley is awesome, and it's a very unforgiving landscape to be at reporting in. I've done some mostly like Colorado River centric reporting out there, and it is incredibly hot, and it's insane to see people out there like harvesting. There's a huge farming economy out there served by the Colorado River, and has been treated as a very extractive place. It's been mined, it's been farmed, it's they have like a natural lake that's drying up, and the air pollution is really gnarly. I've myself usually have to carry an inhaler when I go out there. And this whole concept of like lithium being the new thing to take from Imperial Valley is just sort of a repetitive story. Currently the biggest sources of lithium are in like the deserts of Chile or Bolivia, and it's largely American or Chinese corporations extracting that lithium and globally selling it for the renewable energy boom, which has its own externalities, its own climate footprint that's like very undercounted. And a lot of these places that they're mining are indigenous lands next to sort of poorer communities who then rely on those jobs, but don't really receive much benefit from it. So it's just sort of like interesting to see it land closer to home in California, which is better for like the local economy. And it's better to have everything you need to make green energy happen, like create batteries on US soil, in terms of just like cutting back on the global transport of that kind of material and all of the there's so much to like manufacturing that is globally that's affecting the climate crisis as well. But it's interesting to see that kind of be repeated in Imperial Valley, and it's important that Corey's doing that work and covering it.
Mackenzie, I would love to hear about what you're passionate about regarding the climate crisis.
Climate change is a bummer to talk about, and it creates a lot of anxiety for people, and they just feel like there's nothing. I think that's another reason why people turn from the topic, because they feel like there's nothing you can do. So if I could like create my own beat, it would be to cover just all the crazy interesting technological ideas that we have. Those also including like natural solutions, but we know that we're going to have to, we can't like largely re-engineer the economy without fossil fuels. We have to come up with some interesting stuff to try to combat what we've done to the atmosphere already. And it would be really interesting to like cover those kinds of topics, like, geoengineering, like we create rain in certain places with geoengineering. It's highly controversial. I think I mentioned like, maybe I didn't in the beginning, but what first got me interested in climate change was this concept of like, I read about National Geographic. They were like, oh, we're gonna put mirrors in space to reflect the sun's rays away from the planet. And I just was like, blew my mind. I was like, what else could possibly be a solution? And I also just wanted to say, I love like Corey, like admitting basically that he's not that rugged, like outdoorsy, you know, camping, like environment reporter guy. Cause there is like some kind of trope there that all of anyone who's an environment reporter is like some like wacko, like liberal and, you know, like outdoorsy person, which I will say that I'm probably leaning in that direction a little bit more, but I think we need like urban climate journalists, or like to kind of like generate maybe some like urban climate crisis minded people, because there's plenty to talk about within cities, like urban heat waves and urban heat islands. And, you know, we're going to get into social justice issues and climate justice issues. And it's like, that's where a lot of that is unfolding, is in those, you know, highly populated cities. So, I could go on and on, but I know you have a lot more questions we want to tackle.
For us that aren't too familiar with climate related terms, how would you both explain terms like climate denialism and corporate greenwashing to your readers?
Mackenzie, do you want to take that first?
Sure. Okay. Climate denialism. I feel like you can kind of surmise what climate denialism is from the term, but it mostly just means to me, people that I would assume just say the climate change, human caused climate change is not happening. It's not real. It's something natural. It's something that is manufactured by the media, more like kind of dipping into that conspiracy theory sort of realm. And corporate greenwashing is something that I've done a little bit more reporting on. It's just absolutely flagrant out there right now, because it's like sexy to be a producer of a product that is biodegradable and recyclable and like compostable. But when you dig into these products, a lot of times, especially ones that are like coming from plastics companies or like claim to be some kind of recyclable plastic, we are learning right now, like in the news more and more, that you really can't recycle plastic. And it's just another way of monetizing fossil fuels, because plastic is generated from oil. So there's a vested interest in the plastics world to greenwash that product and make it seem okay and make people feel okay about buying it. And you see that everywhere now. And it's like, anytime I see like a product that's being advertised as like compostable or whatever, and I always take a picture of it and kind of try to find out as much as I can. Because once you start digging into some of the research, it's like, I remember I found, I think it was like a cup or a container. And I dug into like, I tried to find the research paper that backed their claim that it was like, it would break down and compost and go back to, you know, become earth again. And it was based on like one paper out of Brazil, where they had like put the container in like the most ideal, perfect conditions ever. And like, you know, where it would never probably end up. And if you threw it away in a trash can, and it broke down in like a year. And it's like, okay, now we, and then we stamp a claim on that says, oh, it's biodegradable. Like it's so, there's so much there that needs unpacking. And that's kind of how I would explain that to readers. But Corey, if you want to add on to that.
I don't know if I have much to, I mean, I totally agree with everything that Mackenzie said. I guess I would just say that, like, I think it's also like part of our job is to try and, you know, kind of sort of dodge around those terms as much as possible. I think like the terms like greenwashing and climate denialism are certainly useful to put a label on things and to kind of point out patterns of behavior. But I also think that our job is also to try and explain as much as possible how these things are happening and what's happening without, you know, getting too bogged down in the more complicated language, to try and just be clear and be direct and to not get too in the weeds.
Yeah.
For instance, we could say instead of corporate greenwashing, we could just say this company lied about.
Exactly. That would be more understandable for somebody like me.
I agree with Corey too, like that these terms are often like more politicized ones that like maybe journalists wouldn't like naturally use in a story to describe something. And it is certainly our role to be more explanatory. But yeah, we do face having to break that down sometimes.
We have an example of, you know, climate denialism with us right now. To quote an Inside Climate News report, Exxon conducted cutting-edge climate research decades ago and then pivoted to work at the forefront of climate denial, manufacturing doubt about the scientific consensus that its own scientists had confirmed. So how would you tackle this kind of disinformation or false information intended to mislead?
You mean lies?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Corey.
Well, I guess I was just going to say, I mean, in some ways, you know, I think that, yes, I mean, that's clearly just like probably the original example of greenwashing or of lying about climate change. I mean, that research is probably some of the earliest that proves that climate change is happening. In some ways, I do sort of feel like also, though, like, wow, that, I mean, this company did this research, found that climate change was happening, like had it in writing, and then decided to hide it. But like in some ways, like that feels like exactly the kind of problem that journalism and investigative journalism is designed to uncover. Like somebody was meant to get leaked that paper, or somebody was meant to find that paper, you know, in like a recycling bin, or like get it handed to them in a folder in like a parking garage. But like what to me feels like the more the larger question now is almost like, what happens when you have all of this research out in the open, all of this research that's saying that climate change is happening and is going to be this incredibly it is going to upend the lives of so many people around the world. And still you have so many people who are turning away from that reality. I think that to me is sort of what almost feels like a more insurmountable question that that all of us and also that journalists especially have to kind of consider and are sort of struggling to navigate now, because when there's this sort of there are so many questions about and it's become where when it's become so easy to raise doubt or to cast doubt on what is a scientific consensus, for example, I think that is really, I mean, like something that is incredibly serious and something that we're really going to have to figure out how to deal with, but that I feel like so many journalists are still kind of trying to figure out how to approach.
Mackenzie, did you want to add to that?
No, I was just trying to find an article that I had read a while back that, you know, around the same time, there was kind of like this key moment in American history where I think it was around the 70s, where we like had some report like this, and they had like a panel of scientists like and the US government saying like, do we like, is it time to call it now that like climate change is happening? We need to like really ramp back on fossil fuels. And in the end, like these scientists sort of like fell to political pressure and kind of like held off and said, nah, we're good for a while. Or like, it's not sure, it's not clear. Like, we don't have enough evidence, that kind of thing. But to me, it's not really just, that kind of blew my mind. But also wasn't very surprising. Just like, it's not really surprising that fossil fuel companies like Exxon, I mean, they of course probably hire cutting edge climate researchers or climate scientists. I mean, they hire these people so that they have as much information as possible about like what exactly they're doing with their activities. And so it's not a shocker that they knew this. And then obviously like it's not within their business model to try to like combat their own concept of like making money. So, but yeah, I mean, just like Corey said, it's like we as reporters, like it's kind of our role to try to find and hold accountable these companies that like we all know this is a problem, but how can we prove it? And there's been like local evidence of like like local California natural gas companies that were found, they were caught like using, you know, ratepayer money to kind of fight against different energies that were sort of in the way of their own profit margins. And so it's not, this happens all the time. And it's really not surprising that we knew back in the 70s that this was a problem. We knew even earlier than that. In fact, we knew the concept of climate change and how it worked back in 1856. It was like a woman, Eunice Newton Foote, had discovered how the greenhouse, like she coined greenhouse gases as a term and like discovered and demonstrated the effects of CO2 on the atmosphere. So it's always been a battle of, you know, business versus science.
1850s? That's crazy. Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah.
So to add on to what you said about both of you being journalists and your roles as journalists, we know obviously you have an obligation to your audiences. Have you seen reporting these issues lead to climate action?
I don't know. I would say like some of the most, I mean, as a journalist, you always kind of hope that your reporting, especially if it's investigative or something, can lead to a better outcome for the climate. And I'd say there's sort of like little victories here and there. There was a instance where Mayor Tagliori of City of San Diego, he had promised, they had sort of like as an administration, like held up that they were gonna put money towards climate equity projects. So money in areas of town that have historically been underserved or redlined. And then lo and behold, his budget cut that funding. And so we sort of put that into a story and blasted it. And it was enough political pressure to city council reverse that move and put the money back. But it takes that kind of like, it takes having journalists out there in the first place. So it takes supporting organizations like KPBS and Voice of San Diego, which are all donation based. And like we rely on like the public to support us and not like advertising, for instance. But we have to be out there watching these very small, I mean, they can happen, like these kind of decisions can happen all the time. Just like we have to be out there to keep watch and hold them accountable when it does happen. I don't know if Corey, you want to share like your own example?
I think the best example that I can think of isn't necessarily, I don't know if it's necessarily one that I could say where change happened, but I think it's one that's still happening right now. I mean, like Mackenzie, like you said, it takes reporters to be there. It takes journalists to be there and paying attention to kind of have a good sense of when there's something wrong happening and when people might be able to act together to change it. And I think the Imperial Valley is really again one of the clearest cases where I've seen over the last year just a very strong kind of movement where a lot of people, especially you know, especially younger people. These are organizers and young politicians and people who are sort of just concerned about kind of, again, what's going to happen with the future of the lithium industry and what that's going to mean for the Valley. And they have been sort of in lots of different pockets, very active voice in the conversation, going to the powerful elected officials like the County Board of Supervisors and going to Sacramento to speak with state legislatures, with state lawmakers, and going to these companies, which are multi-billion-dollar companies, Berkshire Hathaway, Control Thermal Resources, major energy companies based around the world, and demanding that that they get a seat at the table and get to make these requests and get to guide the future of the industry and have some decision-making power in how that industry should grow in the region. And I think there's still I should say there's still a lot of open questions about the development of lithium in California and in the Imperial Valley. There are still a lot of those questions still haven't been answered. So I think that there's a lot of that's part of why there's so much uncertainty. But I will say that just over the last year, seeing how many people are willing to just get up and say that they feel like they want to make sure that that this is fair to them is has been really really moving.
Yeah, that's definitely really exciting for me to hear, especially as someone who's going to college and still learning about the climate crisis. And I feel like, Alex, do you agree? Like hearing about how like people our age are advocating for change, especially when it comes to climate justice.
Oh, 100%. I think it's important that we're learning about this. I think it's important that we have a podcast about climate action. Because again, like I said earlier, I hear climate change all the time, but obviously, you know, we're not informed or educated, and we're getting all of our information from TikTok or Instagram, and we're not taking the time to see things like you do and your job with KPBS and Voice of San Diego. So I definitely agree. I think it's super important.
I would just mention too that I feel like even talking to a reporter about your concerns over climate change is a climate action. So it doesn't have to be, for instance, and climate action can even be as much as like choosing to like put your food waste in the compost bin, you know, taking the bus, like if you can find a convenient way to do that, choose that over your car. Like that's how I kind of get through the day and get through climate anxiety myself, is just try to focus on like the little like triumphs everywhere when it comes to climate change, because it is sort of like a collective effect, right? If everybody made a few changes to their lifestyle, while granted the bulk of the blame for climate change is on like fossil fuel companies and like the wider economy we can't totally control, but it does help to kind of take smaller actions throughout your day.
I definitely agree. I take public transportation practically everywhere. The Sprinter and the Breeze buses are like my best friends. We also wanted to talk a bit more about youth engagement, because we're youth engagement in climate justice, because we're college students and many of our listeners are as well. So we're wondering if you had anything else to say about like why youth engagement is important.
It's probably the most important thing, because young people, I mean, as the generations go, I was once maybe the young people, right? to another age group. As we go through time, the planet's going to be, you know, warming, and more, we'll be experiencing more extreme effects, more extreme weather, et cetera, et cetera. And so as the generations move on, those generations are gonna be dealing with worse stuff. So I think the youth seems more engaged than ever on this topic, on climate change. And that's just my view of it. I could be wrong, but I actually talked to some like young climate activists I write a biweekly newsletter called The Environment Report. I just kind of gave them the mic and said, like, you know, what are you guys ticked off about? You know, what do you think we need to do? So that gives me some hope. But I think the other thing too is like, I really hope that the youth engagement translates to political, like speaking with your vote and getting involved in politics and paying attention. I think there's a tendency to tune out, especially since there's a lot of distractions. I'm addicted to TikTok, for instance, so I understand what's going on a little bit there. But some young people I talked to this last election, they were probably leaning Democrat, and they decided they didn't feel like their vote mattered, so they didn't vote at all. And like that's one very certain way to make your vote not matter, is to not even add your vote. And to me, that's kind of a waste of your time, because, you know, you can, it still does count, I believe, at least you can see it reflected in the popular vote and definitely in local elections. I mean, if you do care about where you live and you want to like be engaged in local climate decisions, it's all dictated by like specific, very careful vote counting. And we had some pretty, the city of San Diego at least had some pretty important tax increases that they wanted to pass. I know that sounds boring, but a lot of the money was supposed to be used to like fix flooding stormwater systems that like wiped out entire neighborhoods, for instance, or do other, you know, there's other climate things that that money desperately is desired for. And that didn't pass and was like a razor thin margin. And maybe if we had more engaged like 18 year olds and above voting and caring about these things, caring about transit, this huge like tax or this like bond measure to pay for better public transit, which there's just like not, it's very expensive. There's not a ton of money for it. That failed too on a razor thin margin. So like, I feel like the youth are kind of, or what I see the youth caring about these days is sort of losing to the standard like boomer era interests, which are very different. They care about different things. And so I really hope that college students are paying attention and at least like translate. If you're pissed off about the climate, like use your powers that you do have to make a difference.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I would just say that I think young people, talking to young people about this, as a young person, always like makes me more hopeful. And I mean, I entered journalism in the era of the global climate strikes and sort of the youth, a really strong youth movement around climate change. And so around fighting climate change. So I think that there's a lot to really be hopeful about there too. And you know, it makes sense because like Mackenzie said, young people are the ones who have the most stake in this. You know, we all and everyone who's younger than us are the ones who are going to have to live in the world that that all of this is shaping.
Yeah, that's so true. In addition to your news outlets, what other climate information resources do you guys recommend to our listeners?
There's some good. There's more and more like national focused climate news outlets like insideclimatenews.org is one. They basically exclusively talk about climate change through like science, politics, justice, and health, clean energy. And Canary Media is another one that mostly covers the clean energy space. They do a really good job. There's also a site called Industry Dive. It's pretty nerdy, but like they cover like pretty specific topics, like there's like Waste Dive, which covers the state of the like solid waste industry, or they have like Utility Dive version, which covers, you know, electric and gas markets and stuff like that. And those are all really important topics related to climate change.
I would totally back those up. I would also add maybe Grist is an outlet that I think does a lot of really, really great reporting, really great climate focused reporting. And I also think, you know, I would just say that it's always helpful to just keep an eye out and sort of if you like a, you know, read a story or see someone talking about climate change and you like what they say, like to just follow what they do and follow their work. Some of my favorite writers about the climate change and environmental issues are Sarah Kaplan and Daryl Fears at the Washington Post. Daryl Fears, until recently, was a long-time reporter at the Washington Post, and recently took a buyout. But I think that just, you know, there are so many people, so many incredibly smart and talented and dedicated people who are working on this. So I think if there's somebody whose work you gravitate towards too, doesn't hurt to kind of just keep an eye on that too.
Oh, thanks for sharing those cool resources. I'm sure our listeners and us will check them out. For every episode, we like to ask our guests to suggest a climate action our listeners can take to combat climate change. What do you both suggest?
Okay, I'm gonna go with an individual action. I know that, like Mackenzie brought up earlier, I mean, I think that's a really, you know, it's a slippery slope when so much of climate change is, or so much of the contributions to climate change are sort of happen at a very large level, more so than one person can change. But I'm going to say you could always eat less beef or eat no beef. I mean, you know, a lot of it's something that most people can do. And it is something that, you know, out of all kinds of different actions, doesn't necessarily cost you more, might cost you less, might be healthier for you. And also, you know, it's something that will measurably transform your carbon footprint. You know, some studies have suggested that can even cut down the amount of carbon emissions that your diet produces by as much as a third or more. So, that's what I'll recommend.
I think people can do that. What about you, Mackenzie?
I'm going to go with the largely unpopular suggestion of taking public transit. It's like not cool in San Diego for some reason, but like if you go to like New York or San Francisco, or you know, it's like very kind of in vogue to either use your legs, a bicycle, or take transit. But I mean, it's like if you're going to the bars and you've got a bus stop that can get you like somewhat of the way, I think it might make sense to do that in San Diego. We have like nice weather. Walking is not that hard, and it really. The largest source of the greenhouse gas emissions locally, San Diego County, is driving. Like, driving is like the biggest problem here. And I know that the county itself is not set up well for transit, like very little of California is, but it's like when people start demanding it to be better and they like want to use it, that's how it gets built, honestly. So. At least if you come downtown, you can definitely like park and like take a bus into the city, into the central city, and like take it back instead of trying to like drive around and find a parking spot. But that might be just like a very niche pet peeve of mine. So.
That's what I do when I go to downtown. It saves a lot of time.
Yeah. Good. Nice.
I'll have to spread the word more about the Sprinter. I think it's fabulous. But
yeah, what do you guys have in San Marcos for transit? Like, what's the...
We have the Sprinter, which is the train. And then we have Breeze, which is the bus. And yeah, those are the main ones.
The bus. Okay. The Sprinter. So yeah, there's like some cool train vibes in San Diego that are sort of under the radar. Like I like to take a train from San Diego to LA, even though it sucks because once you're in LA, you usually need a car. But I made it happen. I made it work. If you've got people in LA that can pick you up, it's so much better than, you know, just being stuck in traffic. So
definitely, I completely agree. Those are some really sick approaches to climate action. So folks listening at home, please try them out.
Thank you so much, Corey and Mackenzie. We appreciate your efforts as journalists, and the stories you take on are incredibly important. It was so cool learning about how you two are reporting the climate crisis. And for our listeners, you can find Corey Suzuki on KPBS and Mackenzie Elmer on Voice of San Diego.
Yeah, I just want to thank you guys for like elevating journalism and journalists, because it's like, I don't know, it's very kind of rare to be honored in this sort of way, or like to have journalism be like supported. It's really important to us too. So, you know, we're all part of this community as well, and we just want things to get better. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both.
I'm so glad we could make this happen. Want to hear more from Climate to Action, a CSUSM student podcast? Be sure to check us out. Listen to Climate to Action wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on our socials at Climate to Action.
That's at Climate to Action on Instagram and Climate numeral 2 Action on TikTok. Visit for updates, behind the scenes content, and more.
Finally, Climate to Action wants to remind you to take climate action. Do a little climate digging and have fun learning.
Until next time, this is Alex
and Saturn
from Climate to Action, signing off.